Members, the Conference Committee on Senate File 3235, the Data Practices Bill, will come to order. Welcome, everybody. We have had quite a few discussions between the House conferees and Senate conferees, or representatives of them, since our last meeting, and I think we're ready right away to move some consensus items that I think we all agree on. And I don't see the need for testimony on these since we already heard some testimony all these provisions last time. So on these consensus items, I think we're going to go right ahead. And Representative LaForce, I think you wanted to start out.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Good morning, members. If I could, with respect to the House language, turn your attention to page 3, line 23. This is with respect to violations of the data practices statute. And I believe these are consensus numbers, Mr. Chairman, so I'll move the following oral amendment. It's with respect to the numbers. Page 3, line 23, strike the underlined number of 5,000 and reinsert the interlined number of 100. And further down on across on line 23, we strike 50,000 and insert 15,000. And then if I could turn your attention to page 4, line 2, the last number in controversy, would strike 3,000 and insert 1,000.
I guess I'd look for staff guidance on this. Maybe we should do it one section at a time. That's probably a little bit cleaner. Why don't we just stick with the first two,
okay.
Representative Forrest, and section 3 of the House language, which
All right.
is on.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'd withdraw the motion to insert 1,000. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm sorry, I apologize. I believe I had the consensus items wrong, so let me run through my oral amendment. I'll withdraw my oral amendment and reoffer this one. Page 3, line 23. Strike 5,000 and insert 1,000, and strike 50,000 and insert 15,000, just as in my previous oral amendment. I'd move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative DeLaForest, could you tell me, I had in discussion on our side, I had heard some different numbers being discussed, and could you give me a little indication of how we arrived at these figures? 50,000 and 15,000 is quite a difference from where you wanted to start, and maybe you could give me a little idea.
And, Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, admittedly the numbers that came out of the House position and the Conference Committee were somewhat arbitrary, and so there was some discussion for a period of time here about inflation-adjusted numbers, and I believe on the high end, I recall, the inflation-adjusted number would have been right around 30,000. And Mr. Deering, what was the inflation-adjusted number on the low end? You recall?
It would have been $300.
It was about $300. And so, Senator Limmer, as is the case in the legislature with a lot of public policy positions we adopt in a bicameral manner that the governor can sign, it's the product of consensus and negotiation. And so that's what we did. We took the inflation-adjusted numbers and we talked about them and had some discussion, and we decided to draw the line, which is what this ultimately is. It's a line-drawing exercise. All the stakeholders, as well as the policymakers here, agreed upon these numbers, and these were the numbers that we could live with.
Okay.
Just for the record, I know that Minnesota state law doesn't, in my opinion, adequately put enough teeth into our data privacy laws. The areas of remedies and consequences for violating data privacy is probably something we should look at in the future. But when I saw that the House was going in a direction to kind of address this type of a problem, especially when the government is violating the opportunity to provide information to its citizens, I think we have to hold that to a very strict accountability. And I'll certainly, for the sake of consensus, go with the proposal. But I think we as a government have to be held to a higher accountability than even the corporations that sometimes we question. And if we provide the model for providing information to our citizens or protecting the information of our citizens, I think if we're the ones that demand accountability on the part of the private sector, we should be the ones that have the best model for our own behavior. But seeing that this is a consensus discussion and that it's looks like it's going toward an acceptance, I have no other question about it.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I tend to agree with what Senator Limmer said about making sure that our citizens have the privacy that they have a right to expect under law, but especially also for me, and not that one is more important than the other, but maybe as a former journalism major, I'm just as concerned that people have access to information they should have. But I'm also sympathetic to concerns expressed by local government representatives in this discussion that these are very complicated laws, difficult to understand, and I can tell you that even as an attorney in rural Minnesota, I used to receive calls from people asking questions about this issue, and even as an attorney, I would refer these questions to someone who was a specialist in the area who really wasn't someone who even existed in our area, so it often meant having to go down to, you know, a specialist in the metro area to try to get answers. So I think that is really the underlying concern that we should be addressing legislatively. I mean, we are taking a step, even though it's a smaller step than was initially in the House position, to let people know that we are serious about these violations. But I think we should be looking at what we can do to assist local governments with providing accurate information to their employees without it being cost prohibitive to do that. And so maybe what we need is someone at the state level who can be providing that guidance easily. And we don't really seem to have that ability right now. So I think that's the underlying issue that maybe we should be taking a look at in the future.
Chair,
I remember.
If I was a union negotiator, I don't think I would be happy going back to my union membership saying that, hey guys, we kept up with inflation in negotiation. And I kind of have the same perspective on this type of penalty. Keeping up with inflation, since 30 years have passed, and now we have huge computer engines, not only in government, but having access to for our citizens. And when they have a request for particular information that can be gotten by going to a government agency and a few clicks on a computer and then having a violation occur, I don't know if keeping up with inflation is adequate. But, like I said, I'm going to stay in agreement with what I think will be an agreed figure. But it's an area that you're pointing out some need for improvement. I'm also pointing maybe a little slightly off the exact specific subject, but we have a ways to go so that we can have a truly a open government that's at the service of our citizens, and sometimes you have to hold the government accountable.
Any further discussion? Okay, seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the Deal Forest oral amendment. Oh, do we have the amendment? Staff, do we have the amendment? Stand it. Okay. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay, motion carries. Does someone want to move adoption of the second? As amended.
We're going to do subdivision 4.
Right, we'll do that first. Right.
Section 3.
Okay, Representative Lesch moves adoption of
Section 3. Yeah.
Of Section 3. Right. Of Section 3 of the House language contained on page R2, starting at line 3.15. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay. The section is adopted. We'll move on to the next section. Section 4, which begins at the bottom of R2, line 3.26, Representative Dielfort.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the following oral amendment. Page 4, line 2, strike 3,000, insert 1,000.
Okay, line 4.2, strike 3,000, insert 1,000. Any discussion? Okay, seeing no discussion. All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Representative DeLaForest, do you want to move adoption of Section 4?
Mr. Chairman, yes, thank you. We'll move adoption of Section 4.
Okay, any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of adopting Section 4 of the House language signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Section is adopted. We'll move on to what I believe is the next consensus item. And that has to do with airport parking data. There seemed to be a consensus there that no one had any big problem with that. That would be House Sections 5 and 24. Sections 5 and 24. And I believe that would then be, for those of you, R4 and R18. House language on R4 and R18. I'll move adoption of the House language in House Section 5 on R4 on line 4.32 regarding airport parking data. Any discussion? Any discussion? Okay, seeing no further discussion, all in favor of adopting Section 5 of the House language signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The section is adopted. And now on to Section 24 on page R18. Starting on line 16.10, the House language, Section 24. Any discussion to the proposed? I'll move adoption of Section 24. Any
sure.
Discussion?
Sure.
Yeah.
On line 16, there's reference to personal and vehicle information data. Do we know what the personal information is? Is that reference to what the applicant would be providing? Is it limited to that?
Senator Limmer, I don't know if staff has an opinion on that, or whether that's a term that's elsewhere defined. I would think not. Personal and vehicle information data. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the information that's being referenced here is whatever information would be on the credit card that you are putting into the machine.
Okay.
So it's going to be all your personal data, name, address, Social Security, or I'm not sure Social Security number would be included with that, but anything, you know, your age, everything that's on your driver's license, as well as potentially whatever might be embedded in that strip. I'm not sure what all information is even in there, but and then information about your vehicle too, because it's So whatever is on the card that you happen to be using, I think that's what they're making sure is protected, and that's why the references are very general.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson.
Senator Lim.
There's a policy discussion that the legislature still needs to discuss this session, and that's regarding real ID information, which is much more expansive than what you have on our current driver license. If real ID goes into effect, and there is much more cumulative personal data on that, would this then have access to that personal information as so written in the future?
Senator Romer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Romer, this isn't asking for you to put your driver's license, which would be your real ID.
Right.
This
right.
is your credit card.
Okay.
So I don't think it would apply.
You mentioned driver's license.
Did I say driver's license? I'm sorry.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that Senator Lomer and I are on the same side on this. And Senator Lomer, I like that language because I think what's contemplated in that section is overbroad. Because we don't know. I mean, the airport could change their mind in terms of what kind of information they require. Right now, they need the credit card because you have to pay in order to get in, but who's to say that that won't change in the future if there are more heightened federal measures that require people to know who's parking in their parking facilities, and you have to now provide some kind of ID. So I think that part of the reason why I like that language is that it's anticipatory in an option, so we might be asked to show proof of ID before we can even park in our parking facility.
Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, renew the motion that we adopt Section 24 of the House language starting on line 16.10 on the side by side. All in favor of adoption signifies by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Okay, the Section 24 is adopted. I think what we might want to do now is, Senator Limmer, I understand that you have an amendment prepared on the Hennepin County Medical Center data sharing. I don't know if we all have that yet. I don't think so.
I'll have to wait a moment until I get the copy of the amendment.
Fine. And, members, this is House Section 17. Oh, I'm sorry. R-17. R-17, Section 23.
Section 23.
On page R-17 of the side-by-side. Remember, we had some discussion in our last meeting. This would enable Hennepin County Medical Center to share with its various clinics and affiliated organizations data in the same way that other hospitals can share their data. Senator Limmer, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you may recall the discussion Hennepin County was asking for specific language, or Hennepin County Medical Center, that is. We're asking for specific language on how to exchange information regarding medical data at their HCMC facility. They referred to HIPAA language, which is a federal law, and you may know that federal HIPAA law is the provisions in it for data privacy. Some people, and it's certainly debatable, some people are very reliant on HIPAA federal regulations and very confident that that's adequate in its privacy. In Minnesota, we actually exceed many areas of security for data privacy in our state law. We're allowed to do that under HIPAA. We're allowed to have stricter language than HIPAA does. And when I looked at the references to the definition on lines 9, where it referred to treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, the healthcare operation seemed like an overly broad reference. I pulled up the federal language, and there's 4 to 5 pages of definition regarding treatment, payment, and healthcare options, which seemed to be a little bit broader than what we really needed. I didn't want to restrict information unnecessarily, so in referring to a balance point, I've talked to HCMC officials or lobbyists, and we kind of came to a meeting of minds that as long as we didn't do too much damage to our state statutes, if we just simply cited our state statute in a relationship to what they want, they can get the information and the exchange that they need, and at the same time, we can be sensitive to the protections we've already written in to state law regarding medical privacy. If you need any specific reference to this particular 144 section, I'm going to have to rely on our counsel to give them a definition.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemieux, I understand that you've vetted this amendment proposal with HCMC representatives, and they're in agreement with this.
That's correct.
The only comment I would make, and I wish we had Senator Higgins here because she could give a better explanation of why this is so exactly, but I do believe there should be a comma on line 1.8 between the words exchange and may. There's a phrase there that has a comma in front of it and doesn't seem to end with, that should end with a comma. And it's been too long since the days when I might have been able to give a better explanation, but I just know it belongs there.
Madam Chair, I'm going to bow to your expertise in this. Grammar and English weren't necessarily my strong suit.
So, Senator Lemmer, will you incorporate that?
I'll take that as a suspicious yet friendly.
Okay.
Skeptical.
Skeptical. Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, do we have a House position on that? I think we have a strong position that, yes, we'll add the comma.
Mr. Chair, on the comma?
Senator Lemmer.
A strong House position?
Yeah.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Just to be clear, the last line says that this paragraph does not otherwise limit the provisions of sections 144.291 to 144.298. What is that?
Refer to counsel on that.
Mr. Chair, members, that's not today's medical
record. Oh, gotcha. Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion to the Limmer amendment? As amended, I suppose. Any further discussion? Right. So first, we're adopting the amendment before we adopt the section in the.
Although, Mr. Chair, the amendment does adopt the section.
Oh, it does. Oh, that's right. It does adopt the section. Yeah. Okay. So it's all in one fell swoop. Okay. All in favor of adopting this amended provision? All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay, this section, as amended, is adopted. Next, now we're getting into some areas where we might have to do some amending. These aren't consensus provisions, but why don't we start out with the provision in House Sections 16 and 20 to 21. So 16, 20, and 21 regarding location of explosives. We had some discussion, fairly lengthy discussion before on this. And I think, Senator Olson, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the consensus position here would be to add an amendment, which we on the House side affectionately refer to as the Mullery Amendment, because he had raised, or as Senator Representative Lesch has another name for it. But this is an amendment that Representative Mullery had suggested when we were marking up the bill, but we didn't get to. Essentially saying that people who are in the inspection business, whether they're in utilities or working for an explicitly governmental entity, should have the right to know whether there are explosives in a particular place so that they don't get blown up. And we thought that was reasonable. So this amendment has been adopted, the A14 amendment, which incorporates that language, and I think we're in agreement on that. And you look at the very bottom of the amendment, line 1.20, it puts out the effective date 1 year to July 1st, 2009, rather than July 1st, 2008, so that in the intervening year, we can discuss any modifications that need to be made with the understanding that if no modifications are made, this will go into effect on July 1st, 2009. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And again, just for background with respect to the effective date, the principle of dealing with this issue was something that the Senate agreed with, but we did have some concern, since we hadn't had a hearing on this issue, that there might be situations where, beyond just what is addressed in the amendment that you're offering, where someone needs to have this information and what the parameters would be. We really would need to have some testimony Now that this has been adopted, it'll give an opportunity for people who may be concerned about this issue to come forward, and I would expect that next session the House will have, or the Senate will have, a hearing regarding this to see whether there's any additional language that needs to be incorporated before this goes into effect.
Okay. Unlike the last amendment, this one would not effectuate the actual adoption of the section. So I suggest that we talk about the amendment first. I'll move again. I'll move the A14 amendment, which is what we've called sort of the Mullery language, to make sure that certain people can have access to this information. Any further discussion on the amendment? Further discussion. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A14 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. So now I suggest that we go to the actual sections of the side-by-side as amended. And again, just to repeat, these are sections 16, 20, and 21. I don't think there are any further changes, so why don't we go to section 16, which is on page R9. This is section 16, and I think we have consensus here, so I will move adoption of section 16, which starts on line 9.16 of the side-by-side on page R9. Any discussion to the adoption of section 16? Discussion? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of adopting section 16 of the House language, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Section 16 is adopted. Next, section 20 of the House language, which is on page R15, beginning on line 14.17. Any discussion? I will move that we adopt section 20. Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that the effective date, that we have the right language in there, that the effective date of the whole, all of the explosive new language doesn't go into effect until the July 1st, 2009 date, not just these amendments that we added. So, how is that? Do we have that taken care of, or would that be addressed if we adopt these?
You funny?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
the amendment takes care of that.
Okay.
And there's a
contract
committee
that
for that, but
so
you don't need
an effective
date for that.
Okay. Okay, and I think that the language that we adopted in the amendment pertains to this very section 20. So I think what Ms. Honey said, I think we're all pretty comfortable with it. Any further discussion to adoption of section 20, starting on line 14.17? Any further discussion? Seeing no further, Senator Limerick, did you? Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of adoption of section 20, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. The section is adopted. Next and finally, as to this provision, we have section 21, which is just below that, on line 14.25 on page R15. Is there any discussion to adoption of section 21? I'll move adoption. Any discussion?
No.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of adopting section 21 of the House language, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Section is adopted.
I think it's a good one.
Okay, members, I think we're ready to go to the next consensus item, which requires a slight modification. This has to do with the business screening services section of the bill. This was in the Senate language. It was not in the House. It was debated in the House, but there was a vote in committee and it was not adopted. So, but as part of the push and pull here and as part of the negotiations, we've come up with what I think is a novel solution, at least for now, because I think many members of this conference committee on both sides, the House and Senate, feel that this is an issue that we should discuss. I know the Senate feels very strongly about this provision. And nonetheless, we're informed that there is a working group that is already underway to deal with this issue. It will be releasing some recommendations to the legislature on, at least the target date is July 1st of this year. And so there's that tension between wanting to do something and wanting to do something soon about this issue of inaccurate records being disseminated in the employment, housing, and other contexts, and at the same time letting the working group do its work. And so, Senator Olson, do you want to talk about what we've discussed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The decision that we made as a compromise between the House and the Senate is to adopt the Senate language in Section 10, but to amend the section to include an implementation date of July 1st, 2009, which would be a year beyond when the working group's recommendations are due. The Senate has spent considerable time for the last 2 years on this issue and is certainly willing to look at serious before the implementation date, to look at serious suggestions from the working group, but should none be forthcoming that would bring forward a consensus in the bodies of the legislature with the recommendations of the working group, then these provisions will go into effect in July 1st. So again, it's a way of I guess letting the working group know that we're very serious about this issue, but that we remain open to any suggestions that they may make for consideration. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an amendment to Section 10 that would include an implementation date language that would provide for an implementation date of July 1st, 2009.
Okay, and maybe we should consult staff as to where that should go or how we should formulate the amendment. Is that sufficient?
Mr. Gehring, Ms. Ponius?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Gehring.
The amendment would read, after line 9.22, this section is effective July 1st, 2009.
Mr. Chair, then I'd move that language.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Olson. Any further discussion?
Is Mr. Chair, is that something that you'd be looking for input from the public on? It's my proposal here. It's in the bill. So I'm just kind of curious what expectations.
Would please the members here, are you suggesting that we should?
No, I'm not. I'm not one way or the other. I'm just curious.
Okay. Well, I would certainly entertain it if we think it would do us some good if members want to hear about this. I mean, obviously, we're trying to strike a balance here. The Senate has been very clear that this is very important to it. And as part of the negotiations, we understood that. At the same time, we want to let the working group do its work. Obviously, this will up the ante, no question about it. This raises the stakes of the working group, because if we do nothing, we don't get status quo. If we get nothing, we get this new formulation here, statutory formulation. And any of the House members
correct?
Comment on this?
Okay.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify on this particular provision since that possibility has been invoked? Would you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm attorney in Minneapolis, and I represent Reed Elsevier and there are other organizations here that also are concerned about this. You know, I submitted a memo to many of you, and you've seen it. I think the issue, and I haven't seen this amendment, I just was handed it, so I don't know what, I'm not sure what it does.
Yeah.
The amendment. The one you're talking about.
Yeah, no, Mr. Tennyson, the only amendment is to put the effective date out. That's it.
Well, my concern is this. The working group is an interesting group. It's set up by statute in a way. They're almost, it's made up mostly of people who are involved in the criminal justice system. And this amendment would apply to a lot of things that are not covered under the criminal justice system. And that my concern is that you're proposing a law without understanding, without having studied what the issues are in its application. Now, to give you an analogy, it'd be like going out and buying agreeing that everybody should have a suit. And then, everybody's got different sizes and fits, but not knowing what, thinking one size fits all without understanding, the merits of each. Data is used for a lot of purposes, and that has, the concern that the public defenders raised was basically with employment and housing. And I don't have a complaint about that. The Fair Credit Reporting Act governs those issues already for almost exclusively. There may be some things around the edges. The information that's collected, the public information that's made available from various sources, and it's used for a lot of socially desirable purposes. For example, finding witnesses, not covered by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Another example would be finding beneficiaries for a insurance policy that are lost, people, beneficiaries are lost, pension funds. It's used for finding missing children. It's used for a lot of other purposes. Our clients are, to a large extent, a lot law enforcement, insurance companies, banks, and that sort of thing. It's one thing to have a set of principles, and I agree with a set of principles, fair information practice principles. But when you try to draft a statute to apply to those specific principles, you have to take into consideration what you're dealing with. And this legislature has not done that. It's not looked at these in any kind of detail. This task force, or this working group, the Data Mining Task Force, is not made up primarily of lawyers. We've got a lot of people who are not on it, who are not really familiar with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. I've gone to all those meetings except the one last week when I couldn't. And it's been a difficult situation because the committee, that group, is not equipped to look at Fair Credit Reporting Act very well. It's not equipped and is not much interested in, I think, in looking at some of these other issues other than, generally. And I really don't think it's a good idea to adopt a statute and then try to figure out how it's going to be applied later. I mean, if you want to study this issue, that's one thing. And I would suggest that you limit your amendment to employment and housing and move on, and then hold your hearings in committee here in the legislature where you're equipped to bring in witnesses and so on. I think this is I don't like the approach. I don't think it's a very effective or a very good approach. And we're seeing that play out in another area right now with the Social Security legislation where we got these deadlines and can't get agreement on things. So, I guess what I'd like to see is a list of the problems that we're trying to address other employment and housing, and then figure out how you address them. And this is a sort of a backward way of doing that.
General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to say this maybe more broadly than just with respect to this issue. But it seems as though this issue has been out there now for a couple of years, and the legislature has made it clear that it has concerns about how inaccurate information is being used, certainly in the area of employment and housing, but across the board when it's being disseminated on the internet, and it's really difficult to be able to control what the use of that information may be. You know, how, if you can make it available for some purposes, I don't know how we control that it doesn't then become available for any purpose, because we can't really control the internet very well. It seems to me that when this is a broader statement, not just directed against this issue, but what I've seen this legislature, this session, and the same thing happened with the wireless legislation that I was carrying, rather than having specific information come back to us from the industry affected that has a financial interest in this, that would be helpful in addressing some concerns the industry may have. Instead, we have an ability to, or just a lot of concerns raised without any specific suggestions about how we can address those concerns. Or when we do attempt to address those concerns, then we just get another set of concerns raised. When we've made it very clear that this is a principle that we intend to do something about. And so there's certainly going to be another legislative session, not just a working this task force recommendation, but another legislative session when, if there are some constructive, specific recommendations that the industry wants to put forward that still allow us to address these principles, that there's that opportunity. But to always back off a principle so that because there's nothing that moves forward then that addresses concerns that consumers have that we really need to take care of or that we need to provide some protection for.
Mr. Chairman? Well, two things. One, I can't control the internet, neither can you, with regard to dissemination of public information. Secondly, my clients, and I think most of them in a business like this, are not in the business of putting information on the internet. Our customers are other businesses, they're law firms, they're governments, and so on. And the other thing is that they're public records. I think the public policy has been made that certain things are public information. Unless you want to change that and say that some things are not public information or can't be used publicly, then do that. But with regard to the other issue, there were two hearings on this in the Senate. One was in 2007, when I testified with regard to the preemption of issue, and the counsel was asked to prepare a memorandum, which she did. It is an excellent memorandum. I commend it to you in terms of what Ms. Pontius did. And in terms of preemption, what it does, what it doesn't do. So the second one was the day before the deadline, I believe, in the Senate. And I did testify that there's never been an issue raised by anyone in the legislature saying there's a specific problem with these other issues. The issues that were raised and asked to be addressed were employment and housing. Now, there's a whole range of other things that the legislature has not looked at. We'd be happy to testify about those, but there's just not been a forum where we could bring in all of those concerns and explain them. If the legislature wants to study those issues, I'd be happy to cooperate with that. We're trying to do that with this task force. But it's a complex area. It has to be understood. And to throw out a blanket issue saying that we're going to cover all these and then come out and figure out how to solve the problems later, I think it puts us in a very difficult position because we have to try and anticipate everything you're doing here. And if there's a specific set of problems that we're to address, we'd be happy to do that. But they've not been raised by the legislature other than employment and housing. And that's what the public defenders have. And as you recall, Senator, the reason this was raised in part is because of the difficulty of reentry for people who have a criminal record. We're concerned about people not having jobs, not having housing. And that's what, I think that's an appropriate thing for the legislature to do. You have the collateral consequences and all that. This is not collateral consequences. This is information that is public information that's used by the public for legitimate purposes. And if some organization puts an ad on the internet for somebody's criminal record and for 1099 or whatever the example might be, not much I can do about that. And I'm not sure that this legislation will really help that situation. We're concerned about making sure that information is accurate or people are going to buy it from us. So we want to make sure that it is accurate and we correct it. Now, when we deal with employment and housing, we're governed by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, we comply with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. So my concern is that you're putting us in a straitjacket saying, you go ahead and do this. We're going to make this law effective, even though we don't know what it does or how it's going to affect the society. So,
Well, Senator Bethel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the one who introduced this bill in the Senate in 2007, and it was Senate File 914.
Right.
So it's got a fairly low number. It was introduced quite early in the session. We did spend a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee on it. Sent it to the floor, and it sat on the Senate floor for the whole session. And I held it there so Ms. Pontius could, you know, do some more research on the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And, you know, by the time that she'd finished her research, she had an amendment ready to go, which I could have just adopted on the floor and passed the bill. But I was concerned that I wanted the Judiciary Committee to have the opportunity to go back and review the possible amendment. But it was always past the deadline time. So doing anything in 07, you know, that was my call. We didn't. So I had it sent back to the committee. But yes, it was brought up right at the deadline time. But after waiting a whole session in 08, this bill, having been out there for quite a long time and passed through the Judiciary Committee twice and been on the floor, Mr. Tennyson's the only one who's brought any concerns to my attention. Now, he may be right, but I've suggested, you know, numerous times that if there's particular language in there that we ought to be tightening up, let's hear it. I obviously would like to make sure that we're doing, but if it's just the whole idea that is wrong, well, you know, then, you know, but at least the Senate has already spoken on that. You know, we've decided to go in that direction, so. If there's problems, you know, I've been asking to know where the problems are, but, you know, I haven't had any, no one's contacted me besides the Tennyson, you know, express any concerns.
No question.
Thank you. And, Senator Bethel, likewise, with you, the only person who's talked with me on this was Mr. Tennyson. Is this language, is this your baby, or who was the one who was pushing this all last session and this session?
It was originally brought to me, Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, Mr. Sikora and Mr. Ellingson. Mr. Sikora has obviously moved on to a different job. Mr. Ellingson's here, and I forget which organizations were all involved in drafting the language, but that's how it landed on my desk.
Okay. Well, I do have another question, Mr. Chair. You know, and I don't see Mr. Ellingson here. I don't know if this is solely a public defender bill or not, and if it is, okay, it's not. That was my concern. I was going to address it. Was the public defenders that were bringing this. I'm like, what in the world? You know, it's kind of outside of their purview. It is collateral sanctions, but Senator Moore has something she's going to say.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, this issue is an issue that I have huge concerns about as part of the overall work that we've done on collateral sanctions. I recall Senator Wortman, who is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, also had some concerns. She has been doing a lot of work in expungement. And so at one point, I believe there were three separate data harvester bills introduced in the Senate. A provision was included in Senator Wortman's expungement bill. Senator Bethel had this business screening services provision as part of another bill, which we were able to separate and sent the business screening services on its own. I had a very comprehensive bill that took a look at data harvesting in totality because we had some concerns, not just about the private data harvesters, but I had concerns about what kind of data our government was selling to data harvesters. Our counties, our cities, our courts, what kind of data are we selling to them and how should we regulate that? And when this was moving forward, we thought that this was just a baby step. But we do intend to follow through on looking at all of those areas. So it wasn't just a blip in the radar that, you know, somehow this came out of a corner somewhere. It's a concerted effort to look at data harvesting. And this is not the last that we will be looking at this issue.
General.
And, excuse me, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, with those comments, a lot of the discussion we've had in the Senate has been around the fact that information that gets out there today has a lot of consequences regarding, and it's very difficult to control, as Mr. Tennyson said. It affects people with respect to their ability to get housing, affects their ability to get employment, it affects their insurance rates, it affects their ability to obtain loans or do anything that relates to credit. It affects how much they pay for a multitude of things that are credit related. And so it's really important that we do what we can to make sure that the information is accurate. And our concern is that businesses that are engaged in selling that information to other, to those who are seeking that information, provide the most accurate information possible, and that things that have, where people have, say, been charged with something that's been dropped or arrested by mistake, or somehow that information is out there in a public record, that if someone is selling that as accurate, that they should have had to go back and make sure within a month that they have verified the accuracy of that information, because it has such tremendous consequences with respect to people's lives. If there are unintended consequences in this legislation that need to be addressed with particular language that would relate to some concerns, then we still do have another session, but we would need to see something very specific, because it's a principle we all are concerned about.
I'll just add to Senator Olson and members that I personally supported this when we were marking up the bill in committee. I lost that argument, and it disappears from the House bill, and so the overall House position is somewhat muddled. I guess officially there is none, because the full House didn't act, but the committee did act and said no. But to me, this does seem like it's really about accuracy. There are other proposals out there that I don't support at this point, which would prohibit the use of arrest records for an arrest that did not result in a conviction. And I thought, personally, that went too far, because there are very good reasons why you might want to know someone's arrest record, even if it didn't result in a conviction, which we don't need to go into today. But this seems to me to be talking about accuracy. And Mr. Tennyson, just as an example of some of the modifications that I'm sure all of us would entertain in the upcoming year, assuming on the House side that we're back here, never know what voters will do in November, but assuming for the sake of argument that we are, on page R16, for example, starting with subdivision 2, this says that basically the records have to be scrubbed every month. Now, maybe the working group will decide that, that's just not feasible, that it's just the cost would be too high, and that it should be every 3 months or twice a year or something. I don't know. I don't think we're looking here to put LexisNexis out of business and impose huge costs on LexisNexis or any other company doing this kind of stuff. On subdivision 4, I'm on 9.5, it seems to me that would be pretty easy to comply with. It's just a disclaimer that I can see being literally put on a rubber stamp or being printed on all the documents saying, warning, information, the enclosed information may have been expunged, sealed, or otherwise have become inaccessible since the data was first obtained. That seems like pretty easy, standard, boilerplate language. But maybe the working group will say, well, that's not as simple as it looks either, and maybe that's more of a difficult task. I don't know. And then on the FCRA issue, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and whether there's preemption, if it's preempted, it's preempted, and then there's really nothing that much to worry about. I guess what I'm saying is this is a relatively concise piece of text here, and there's a fear now that we can hear from stakeholders about unintended consequences, but I think it certainly ups the ante and raises the stakes for this working group, that's for sure. And I think, speaking for the House side at least, we will listen to that. I mean, if there are serious concerns in the intervening year, we're not here to impose undue burdens on anyone, and we want to hear how we can improve this language.
Representative West. Thank you. In light of the fact that we are essentially sort of agreeing to agree later, which, as any contracts attorney will tell you, you never do or shouldn't do. And it is going to be there's going to be a working group that's going to be working on this in the interim. Mr. Tennyson has been more than forthcoming in stating the interests of his folks who are going to be working on this. But we haven't heard from the other side, and I'm wondering if we could hear from someone from the public defenders, okay, whoever that may be. Is there anyone who fits that description, who wishes to?
I just want to add one other thing.
And you represented from your last chance either. Go ahead.
Representative from West, Thompson West is here too.
Okay.
Support my position.
Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Steve Holmgren, and I'm the Chief Public Defender in the 1st Judicial District. It is true that the public defenders are interested in this bill, and primarily because, in our view, it ensures accuracy of data. In general, I would say that most people would recognize that the criminal justice system is a process that is constantly changing, and I tend to look at accuracy in those terms. It's almost more like a movie than it is a snapshot. In that, as one of the senators here mentioned, things change. People are arrested, they're charged, some aren't charged, some people are convicted, some people aren't convicted. Appeals happen, which change the process. And really what this does is ensure that the criminal justice record is as accurate as it can be at the time. That's the idea behind the refresh provision. Ultimately, I think what this does is capture that idea that records change over time and that they should be looked at periodically, should be updated periodically when held in the hands of third parties. This wasn't so much of a problem in the past because people generally would come to the source, the government, for these types of records, but now that these services are gaining popularity, we see more and more employers, landlords, and other people going to these agencies for this information. So that's the gist of the accuracy component. I would also note that what it does is provide citizens with a remedy if there is an inaccurate record about them. They can go to the government source and have it corrected there and have some assurance that these third parties will also catch on to that inaccuracy in that corrected record because of the refresh provision. Right now, I'm afraid if someone were to find out a record's inaccurate about them, and there's some inaccuracies, I don't know where they would go to find all of the potential business screening services that are out there. I think you could go to the major ones, certainly, and say, there's an error about me, but how you would find them all, I do not know because of the internet and the variety of folks that are out there doing this sort of this business now. Thirdly, I would note that the Collateral Sanctions Committee did in fact recommend a bill or a provision very similar to this. A lot of the language is pulled out of that report and it matches up with this report, so it's not just the public defenders. There are very many other people interested in this provision. Mr. Tennyson mentioned that he thought it painted with a broad brush. I would note that the criminal record is what this applies to. It's narrowly defined. It doesn't apply to records that are not criminal records. I also am a member of the study committee that is studying this. I don't believe this would interfere with our committee's work. In fact, it would probably help us focus in on some of these issues. So that's basically...
Mr. Chair. Representative Lett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holmgren, are you and... let me ask a question first. Do you ever find yourself in the position, any of your staff attorneys, public defenders, some public defenders in the 1st Judicial District, representing clients after their criminal actions are completed or appeals exhausted, and representing the capacity to correct incorrect information in civil court or regarding a job they lost or housing that they lost because of an incorrect record? Do you find your attorneys in that position ever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, no, our attorneys do not do that type of work. Not that we, I should add, unless it's
specific to some sort of a plea agreement where a record would be expunged as part of a plea negotiation, then we could very well be into that arena where we would do that. Okay. But normally we don't because we don't have the resources to do that.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Holmgren, thank you, because that's why I'm asking you about not having the resources to do that. Are you and Mr. Ellingson here today in your capacity with the Board of Public Defense?
I am, yeah.
Holmgren. Okay, thanks. Oh, and Mr. Chair, this is why I'm asking this. What we're doing is we're setting ourselves up for discussions in a working group over the course of the interim. And as we know around here, legislation is crafted both by our individual ideas and also heavily by the stakeholders and who brings the information to the table. And I have a substantial amount of concern, especially in my capacity as sitting on the Finance Committee for Public Safety, where we're trying to fund the public defenders who come in every year and say we don't have enough resources. And I see the lack of resources that public defenders don't have in my role as a prosecutor, because they're scattering around in different courtrooms all the time with too many clients. I understand that. But I guess I'm confused about why public defenders are leading the charge on this, if that's the case, because I see that as outside your purview. I don't understand why Civil Legal Services isn't in here on this, or someone else who is leading the charge, perhaps the private private attorneys with concerns about that. I just don't understand why, with public defenders being stretched thin enough, you're stepping outside the role in what you characterize creatively as this is more of a movie, not a snapshot, in an effort to help clients beyond what I think your charge is.
Mr. Chair, you know, with all due respect to my fellow St. Paul representative, I think that's just a little bit unfair. We're legislators, and I have been one of the major driving forces of this specific piece of legislation, as I stated before, along with Senator Betzel and Senator Wortman. We created the study group. We asked for people to participate. I believe that Mr. Tennyson has been asked to participate in the study group. I believe that Mr. Tennyson has committed to providing, you know, an expert on Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act to the study group. We asked for different stakeholder groups to participate so that we can have a full and comprehensive input into what the outcome is. So that when we bring ideas back to the legislature, we know that it has been vetted with the various sectors and individuals who work on behalf of individuals who fight or affected by this. I think it's perfectly appropriate for the Public Defender's Office to have an interest in this, because the people they work directly with, we have charged them with the responsibility to work with our citizens. We've asked them to participate, to give us input, and I think it's a little bit unfair, I believe, to put the public defenders on the spot in that way. Ms. Holmgren has been gracious enough to come when asked to come to testify why they like or dislike this, as I'm sure there are other people in the audience who would and could testify about why they would like or dislike something like this, and I think it's a little bit unfair to make it just about the public defenders.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Moore. Well, first, this is a conference committee, and there's very little I think that's unfair here. It's about vetting ideas and finding out from which direction the ideas come. I've been a great supporter of the public defenders in the past, especially as it comes to financing in the bills that come through, where they come and request money for more resources. There's no question about it. But when asked who are the driving forces behind this in terms of bringing the ideas to the table, everyone on this committee is incredibly busy. We want to know who's going to be active in the working group in crafting the solution that supposedly is going to come through for the 09 date. So I think it's absolutely fair to say, okay, who's involved and what are your motivations for being involved? Because those are the nuances that are going to be involved in the language changes that occur over the interim. And I just want to state for the record that I have concerns about that. And I wonder, and I'm sure public defenders will come and talk to me after this and maybe offer a better explanation, but that's what I'm looking for here, a better explanation. If this is their priority, collateral sanctions, then I'm going to need to know maybe if other areas that have been discussed in the past, this session or previous sessions, are less of a priority. That's all I'm looking for.
Mr. Holmgren.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I should explain a little bit more. I'm much more involved in these issues than a chief public defender. I'm also the first vice chair of the State of Minnesota Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force. I'm also a member of the State of Minnesota Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group. So I'm heavily involved in these areas. But I'm not officially here today because we haven't made any recommendations yet as part of the task force or the policy group. That's part of what the study is very much about. So, but from a public defender's perspective, we are very concerned about accuracy of information and collateral consequences, as our prosecutors, as you know, because these collateral consequences are beginning to affect our ability to do work in the courtroom and fashion meaningful remedies that allow us to protect the public and the interests of our clients. The American Bar Association recently came out with some sort of a recommendation saying that defense attorneys and prosecutors now need to start looking at collateral consequences to be able to do sort of holistic approach to representing people. So that's part of an explanation as to what our interest is. Certainly, I would say it goes beyond housing and reentry in that we're generally concerned that the consequences that citizens suffer by reason of criminal justice information being out there be appropriate and be accurate so that they don't have to go try to explain away some inaccuracy.
Representative Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any more in the way of comments or questions. I will say that I do have the concern, though, not just with respect to this conference committee, but also with respect to future public safety finance bills.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Lush, and I know you wanted to make that a part of the record and make that known publicly. But at this point, I think this still remains a consensus item. I know we've lost a couple of members, but before we lose... okay. Representative Simon's back. I think I'm ready. I'd like to move Section 10 as the Senate language in Section 10 on R-15 as amended with the July 1st, 2009 implementation date.
Senator Olson, I'm advised that we haven't yet adopted the amendment.
Oh, okay. Then I'd like to move the amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion on the amendment? Mr. Tennyson, one last word.
All right.
And other senators have to...
Chair, remember the committee. I don't want to try it. I understand where it's going. But let me make two things clear. One, the Fair Credit Reporting Act governs employment and housing. Period. The people have rights and so on under that. Secondly, this bill will not have one iota of benefit to somebody who has a criminal record that's accurate. You're only talking about some small number of criminal records that's fully inaccurate. The Fair Credit Reporting Act requires the information to be current, and it's challenged and corrected and so on. So we're talking about some small group of cases. And I've asked the public defenders to tell me how many there are, and they can't tell me that. The problem with reentry is much broader than this bill. And in terms of, it's not a collateral sanction or collateral consequence. This may be what the public perceives. The other thing is, I did learn through the task force that the state apparently dumps their entire database every month when it's purchased. So the database that's there before is replaced. So expungements and sealings are in part of that, so that's not the issue. And nobody's identified the volume or scope of this. We have some theory that there's a lot of people being discriminated against or harmed because of inaccurate criminal records. And I haven't seen any data on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tennyson. I appreciate that. Senator Olson has renewed her motion with respect to the amendment having to do with the effective date of July 1st, 2009. Any further discussion on the amendment for the effective date? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay, the amendment is adopted. And Senator Olson, you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd now like to move Section 10, the Senate language, beginning on page R 15.1, as amended.
Okay. Senator Olson moves adoption of Section 10 as of the Senate language as amended. Any further discussion to the adoption of the amendment? For the discussion, seeing no further discussion, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The section is adopted. Members, I understand that the Senate has, at least the Senate Democrats, I believe, have a caucus at 11 o'clock. Is that right? Do you know, can any senator tell us how long you anticipate that lasting? I think we have, for the record here, I think we have one possibly complicated provision on the sort of more consensus items that we were going to talk about. And the other thing I wanted to do is accommodate Representative Abler, who was nice enough to come here. And
1 minute.
I think we'd like to do that now. Representative Abler had a provision that he put on the floor, and there were questions last time about what it does and why we need it. And none of us, having had the benefit of looking at this in committee, we thought we'd defer to the author. And this is, just to understand, members, and just to take a minute, this is section, House Section 17, which has to do with sharing of data with research institutions. Representative Abler, thanks for coming.
This provision will make the bill really one you can be proud of, I think. So it's a very important provision, but it's very small. DHS sits on a mountain of data about fee-for-service and general assistance medical care, which I believe would be valuable if it could be properly mined and analyzed in a safe, way. And this amendment merely asks, this is a group of at the DHS which figures out some of these things that's in place now. This simply asks them to come back with a plan about how this data might be mined. And then if it were to require legislative action, that would be another matter for another day. But this is just a request for a plan.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Any discussion or questions for members of the committee? Senator Lim. And members, I'm sorry, Senator, just so those following at home, it's page R10 of the side-by-side.
Just people following at home?
Chair, going on to the next page, R11. Line 9. Did we earlier change the reporting date from December 15th to January 15th of 2009? What did we do?
I think, Senator Limmer, I think we talked about it. My notes reflect that we talked about it. I don't think we adopted anything.
Senator Bentel raised that question.
He did raise it, is my recollection, and that's what staff tells me too. Senator Olson.
Representative Simon, Senator Limmer, Mr. Chair, I think the reason we didn't is because we weren't decided that we were going to incorporate this language. And so, I think it was just kind of put on hold.
I think we can revisit that if we revisit the issue and discuss the issue. But I just wanted to give Representative Abler the chance himself to address some of the questions that arose in our first hearing. Any further questions of Representative Abler on this issue while we have him? Anyone? Okay. Oh, Senator Olson.
I was just going to say, Representative Abler, that I think the overarching concern we had with this is just that this is a fairly significant idea that we felt should have been vetted through the health care committees in the Senate as well as through our committee, because from a health care standpoint, there's been so much going on with that issue. It seems as though the people involved in that health care reform process and those of us on the committees would have wanted to have the opportunity to get a lot more testimony to discuss this with Health and Human Services and whomever else may just go forward with something like this in a data practices conference committee.
And just to that point, the original version was allowing them to do it, and I thought that was a big step. And this is just asking the department to come back with saying how they might go ahead with that. And at that point, that would go through the various committees, and then if we were going to do it, then we decided to do it. That's all. It's just having them work on that idea.
Representative Simon, Representative Abler, what we don't know, though, is even the history. If there was an initial bill allowing them to do that, where did it go in health care? Does the Senate have a position on it? You know, it seems to be so much more tied to the area of health care that resurrecting it in data practices without any input on the health from the health care side of things seem to be a little bit odd to us.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, some of the other concerns that I think we had was why was this focused on four medical schools? Or there's a mention that this would be applicable to University of Minnesota Med School, Mayo Medical, Minnesota Health Sciences, University Institutes of Clinical Systems Improvement, and then in addition to that, and other research institutions. And is that any research institution found in the state of Minnesota? We kind of had a little discussion of why there was four facilities mentioned, and then the rather broad reference to kind of everyone else. And I was wondering if you might be able to just clarify why it was written in this way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I can certainly clarify. It's a request. Sometimes the department lacks for ideas, and so I thought we'd give them some ideas about who might be able to use this, and I just ticked off four groups who I know would be, or five, whatever the number was, of groups that would certainly be likely to ask for this data and actually be in a position to use it. It's only a request for how they might go about doing it, and so the department might decide that some of those groups are good ideas. They might limit them to only public or privately funded ones or some idea, and so I believe it's pretty safe, and I hope it's an idea that you can go forward with, and just to keep ideas coming out. A lot of good ideas never get beyond the idea in somebody's head stage, because we don't push the department. The departments are to do what we have them do, and eventually the data that would be coming out of it would be something you'd be interested in knowing. That's how it wound up in this data bill, so I hope you can support it. And the date of whenever the report comes is moot to me, so make it when you like.
Any further discussion? Okay. We're not going to take any action right now, but Representative...
Thank you, members. I appreciate that.
Members, in terms of time here, I know that the Senate Democrats at least have a caucus now, and the question is, in our... this next provision that we want to discuss might take a while, and we thought, well, can we do it in 10 or 15 minutes? So in an abundance of caution, we've decided to temporarily to recess. And I just want to see whether if we reconvene at 1 o'clock, whether that would pose any problem for the senators. I think we're okay with that on the House side.
Senator Schreck.
Okay. Senator Moore. Would 12:30 work better?
Mm-hmm.
I think we can.
I have another conference meeting, but can we do it this afternoon? Later this afternoon? Let's say 4 or 5?
House members?
I know that
House DFL members might have a caucus. I don't know if we do or not. 2 o'clock. Okay. How about 4 o'clock?
Okay.
Would 4 o'clock be okay?
I would appreciate that.
Okay, great. Let's do that. We are in recess.
We always like to accommodate, Senator.
We are in recess until 4 o'clock. Thank you, members.
We'll resume the hearing, the conference committee, on Senate File 3235, the Omnibus Data Practices Bill. Welcome back. I think we've only got a little bit of material to go through to wrap up. And what I'd like to do is next address the issue that is taken up in Sections 14 and 15 of the House language, starting on the very, very bottom of R7, but really page R8. And that has to do with applicants for appointment, people who are actually appointed, and then elected officials. And just for some background, at least from the House standpoint, we discussed this earlier, but I think it bears repeating. The reason this was in the bill is it was meant to counteract or really reverse a temporary classification that was done just a few weeks before session, I think, or maybe it was a couple of months before session. Oh, it was end of February. Okay, so it was during session. That basically put off limits, at least for the time being, certain information, address information and the like, about people who were in appointed office. And we have to go into how that arose, but it did arise. And when that came out, there was a pretty strong reaction by a lot of people
including members of the House, who thought, well, that wasn't quite right, at least how we interpreted it. And we understand the reasons for the temporary classification, but in effect, we thought it enabled people to hide from the public, even though they had stepped forward to be a part of the public process, and we didn't think that was right. And so that's how this language came about. What I think we should do is discuss these sections in the context of an amendment which should be on members' desks, the A16 amendment.
Okay.
In front of you, I should say.
Okay.
It's coded S3235A16. And what I'd like to do before I ask, well, maybe we'll have someone move the amendment. Does someone want to move the amendment? Okay, Representative Lesch moved the A16 amendment. Before we vote on it, I was hoping that we could have Mr. Gehring walk us through us and just describe this. I should say, just by way of introduction, that this amendment does not pertain at all to Section 15. Section 15 on page R8 pertains to elected officials, and we can talk about why that isn't so. But Senator Olson, do you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I was going to point out, though, is that the amendment does include the language related to the issue of whether we should be requiring an actual residential address or simply a mailing residential address. And see, that seems to be the most, the substantive issue that remains to be resolved. So I don't know whether we want to move the amendment until we've actually discussed that issue. I suppose we could move it and then have it in play and then amend the amendment, but I'm not sure. Senator Betzel, from a procedural standpoint, or Mr. Chair, maybe what the best approach would be.
Senator Olson, I'd like to at least have Mr. Gehring walk through it and have it moved, and we can then, if people want to take things out of the amendment or amend the amendment before we adopt the amendment, I think that would be sensible, and that's maybe where we're headed here.
Okay.
So with that, Mr. Gehring, if you would just walk us through the amendment, and again, it pertains only to Section 14, which has to do with appointment, not elected officials.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are basically three substantive pieces to this amendment. I'll just walk through them starting at the top. Lines 1.3 and 1.4 adds language specifying that the data that's being classified in this section of statute only pertains to data that's collected because a person has applied for appointment to a public body. So this is clarifying language that cuts out the potential misinterpretation that the data that any government data held about an individual who applies to be appointed to a public body would be classified. So things like, you know, someone's fishing license or other data that's not related to the appointment would not be classified pursuant to this section.
So, Mr. Gehring, for example, you and I were going over the example of the potato board. There is such a thing. So if I applied to be a member of the potato board, that doesn't mean that subsequent data that comes into the public stream, like the fishing license data, would be somehow shielded, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's the Potato Research and Promotion Council.
Potato Research and Promotion Council, right. Good catch. Okay.
Mr. Chair, line 1.8 and 1.9 adds substantive new language to the list of items that would be public on an individual applying for appointment to a public body, and this would cover the Potato Research and Promotion Council. Individuals who apply for appointment to a public body following the procedures established in Chapter 15, which is the open appointments process. When you apply for a position through that process, there's an application that's required by statute to be filled out by an applicant, and it contains other data that is not listed in clauses 1 through 7 in the bill. And so this language on line 1.8 and 1.9, the amendment would specify that all the data contained in that application would be public, so that it could be, you know, viewed by individuals who wanted to see a person's application for appointment, or it could be used in certain reporting requirements that are required by statute.
And Mr. Gehring, thank you. Just so we're clear, I understand, and members should have this also in front of them too. This is sort of an exhibit or an example. This is what we're talking about, and Mr. Black, who's with us here today from the Secretary of State's office, brought this issue to our attention. Under the open appointment system, someone, generally speaking, who in the Secretary of State's office collects this data, this is what they fill out, this document, if they want to be part of
what are we calling it? The Cato Council, I'll call it, not board. The Cato Council, someone
research
might fill out.
Promotion.
Right, I'm sorry, the Research and Promotion Council, pardon me. If I wanted to be part of that group, I might fill out a piece of paper like this, and it includes other items, and Mr. Black was very helpful in explaining that, you know, unless we're going to ask the Secretary of State's office to go and redact all this stuff that we don't include, we're going to want to do that. As you can see on here, it gives us optional information, only optional, where a person can put their race, political party, sex, disability status, national origin, etc. And then there's some other items on here, too. So rather than make life even more difficult for the Secretary of State's office, that's why that provision is in there. Mr. Black, did you want to mention something about that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bert Black, legal advisor for the Secretary of State's office. I think we wanted to provide you with some background information on it. Actually goes to both points, but I think there's more column inches on the open appointments, and of course it's mostly about the previous language, but I did want to I also have the on page, let's see, 2, 4, 6 of this handout, there's also the annual report. I just wanted to give you an example of that. I did not choose the potato, I'm sorry, I didn't coordinate this. I didn't choose the potato research
promotion,
promotion council. I instead picked the first, it is 6, 7, 8, 9. On page 9, you'll see the listing there first alphabetically. It's the Acupuncture Advisory Council. And I have to tell you, I noticed
that... Let me just interrupt you. I don't have page numbers.
I'm sorry. There, it's, no, it's not numbered. The actual... It says 13 at the bottom.
Oh, okay.
Of this particular page. It's not the 13th page, but it happens to say 13. And actually, until I saw this, I happened to notice that the first name on there is somebody who is actually one of my doctors. So, but this is how we report annually, and this is also in Chapter 15. And I just wanted to make sure you had that before you. And then the memo goes on to talk about the elected official thing, and I won't talk about that now. But this is just additional information on our open appointment process.
Mr. Black, just for our present purposes, before we tinker with the amendment in the way we're going to, on line 1.8 and 1.9 of the amendment, do you have that in front of you?
I do have the amendment.
Does that take care of the concerns that you've raised?
I believe that, in addition to the 1.3 and 1.4 information, takes care of those concerns. I did consult with Mr. Gehring to make sure that my interpretation was correct, and I believe we concluded that, yes, that takes care of both the initial application and the annual report.
Okay. So for present purposes, Mr. Black, I think that's the information we need, not to kick you away, but do other members have questions about this? I thought it would be good to have Mr. Black here to talk about that issue. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Mr. Black can answer this question, but on line 4 of the amendment, there's a reference to appointment to the public body. Is there a definition of what public body is for the purposes of this amendment?
Let me defer to Mr. Gehring or Ms. Connors on that one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, there's not a definition of public body, but I think that it would just go by the plain meaning, which would include public boards and commissions and advisory groups that are sort of governmental in nature.
Chair, would being a member of the elected, of an elected office, would that also be a reference to public body?
Senator Limmer, I'll defer again to Mr. Gehring or Ms. Tanya.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, if you're an elected official, you aren't appointed to the body, so you would be...
Well, I was... You'd be appointed? I don't know if that's true.
Senator Shack.
You can be appointed to an elected body, so what's wrong?
That is true.
City
council? True.
To be an elected official, appointed to an appointed body.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you can't be elected to an appointed body.
No, but an elected official, we do it with legislators all the time.
Senator Bethel?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, well, I don't know what... Okay, that answers the question. I don't know if we necessarily want to do anything about that. Let's,
well, Chair, I think it answered the question, but for the purposes of definition, I don't think we have one yet in the public body. Someday in the future, some other future legislature might be, will be looking at this and trying to figure out what this is.
Mr. Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lindbergh, I would also just point out that we use the term public body because if you can see that on line 8.14, the language that's stricken from current statute uses the phrase public body. So presumably the interpretation that would be applied to the new use of the term public body would be consistent with the interpretation of the old use of the term public body. So I don't think we're establishing a new, we're not establishing a new term in Chapter 13. You're correct, though, that it's not specifically defined.
Darren, do you want to walk through the rest of the amendment?
Mr. Chair, starting on line 1.10 of the amendment through 1.12, this is adding language. Once a person is appointed to a public body, additional items about them become public, specifically contact information. And this is clarifying that where the language requires that a person's residential address be made public, the amendment specifies that it's a residential mailing address that has to be public or an alternate mailing address to separate it from the reference to electronic mail addresses, which is referred to in Clause 3 on 8.32 of the bill. Lines 1.13 to 1.15 of the amendment specify that once a person is appointed to a public body, either a telephone number or email address where the appointee can be reached is made public. The current bill specifies that both a telephone number and email address is made public. This is to address a concern that in certain areas of the state, some appointees might not have access to email or might not use email. So an appointee could specify either a telephone number or email address, or if they chose and had access to both, could make both of them public. Finally, lines 1.16 to 1.20, the new paragraph C specifies that if an appointee is provided an email address or telephone number by the public body under which the appointee is serving, that publicly provided email or telephone number address or telephone number is public regardless of the classifications in this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Guerin. Before we go to the discussion of the amendment, I just want to make sure, I guess, that I, for the record, understand it. Basically, the first portion makes clear that it's only collected by a government entity as a part of the appointment process. I think we talked about that. And then there was the Secretary of State's provision on 1.8 and 1.9. I think, I would hope that we're okay with that. Of course, lines 1.10 and 1.11 get to an item of possible difference here, and we discussed that. We touched on it in the last hearing, and I'll acknowledge that. This is about whether someone who has, and I think at this point, Mr. Gearing, we're talking about people who got the position, not just applicants, but people who got the position. They were, in fact, appointed to whatever it is, the Potato Council, for example. Whether or not they have to provide their actual home address or some other mailing at which the public can reach them. And that's where we're at. Now, this amendment right now, were we to adopt it right now, and its pristine form in A16 would say, would give an alternate mailing opportunity. But I understand that there's some dissenting voices here, and so maybe we should just have that discussion right here. I know we've had it before, but now that we've got the amendment before us, I think it bears repeating. I got the sneak preview from Senator Olson that there's some contrary views on this, so we might as well state what they are, and you can seek to amend the amendment if you wish. Senator Bethel?
Well, Mr. Chair, like this morning, you know, this is an issue that the Senate had not spent any time on, and if there are people in here who want to weigh in, I think that would be helpful to the Senate conference. I think I'd like to hear if anybody's got any concerns. Just as a note, Senator Limmer had raised a question about, in the Senate side, about, you know, can somebody be appointed to fill out, you know, an elective office, and I guess the answer is yes, although I guess a strict reading this would be appointment, but that may be covered, at least for knowing the residents, on 8.2 to 8.21, because, you know, normally
in many appointments for elected positions, those would be local level ones. I can't imagine a statewide thing for appointments, but residency requirements are usually required, for instance, to fill out a city council term. And you have to prove that you're living in the district or the city or whatever. So I think that they, you know, if you're being appointed to fill out a city council term, you have to state your actual address, not just some alternate address. So I think at least that point may be covered. But again, we're not today, as I understand it, going into elected officials' data, so I don't know how far we need to go there. But I'd like to hear if anybody's got any issues on the appointed side and only the appointed side. So, anybody here who has any issues or concerns? Because we did not hear this at all, and I don't know if there's any issues out there that we need to be sensitive to.
Okay. Are you talking about the discussion as the entire amendment or the issue of the home address versus providing a means for an alternate mail?
Well, we never discussed any of it, Mr. Chair. So, okay. And before we get too far, I think the Senate has noted on page 1, line 8 of the amendment, it says voluntary, and we think that should be voluntarily.
Okay. I think I can just incorporate that. Or no. It was an election of the amendment, so we wish to incorporate that.
Can you tell me the line again on this? Page 1, line 8, where it says voluntary, we think that should be voluntarily.
Yes, I would agree with that being incorporated.
Okay. Is there anyone here who wishes to testify on the substance of the amendment? Mr. Neumeister, will you identify yourself for the record?
Chairman, members of the Conference Committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Very specifically to the issue about the addresses, one of the things I think it's important to realize, public body is a broad term which can be used for, let's say, a county, could be used for a city. And there's a lot of boards and a lot of commissions on local levels where it's important to get diversity. All kinds of diversity, and particularly when you deal with planning commissions, zoning commissions, and those kinds of things. Now, I handed out to you last time a go-around that there was a posting on a website and a blog that talked about all those things, and one of the things that talked about is, like, let's say there was a planning commission of 7 people, and they're looking at issues citywide. 5 people may be from the east side of St. Paul, while only 2 from the west side. There was also some examples in there, about 8 or 9 people added on to the blog there. They were talking about how in Minneapolis there was a situation where a number of people were appointed from different parts of town, but no northeast or north parts of Minneapolis were on the board or commission. Also, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, diversity also goes in, when you talk about diversity, it's also sometimes, depending on the issue or what has been selected to look at, is from different neighborhoods or different areas, it's not just in terms of physical kinds of things, it also can mean things of community, where it's important to get a community representation on some of those things. Again, this is more so like in terms of urban areas, more so of urban areas. And whether or not this would apply to like some of the things that have been happening where there's been state appointments in regards to looking at natural resources and all that, I think it's very important to also get a geographic diversity statewide. So it's very important for accountability and for people to see who's getting selected. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's at least my argument with the specifics of the address. I can address the issue of the amendment later, but that was my main point.
Thanks, the address. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Okay, I, at the risk of putting someone on the spot, Ms. Higgins from the League of Cities is here, and I am wondering whether she or anyone else she recommends, if not her, could comment on this hypothetical. And I know I'm fixated with the example of the prosecutor who puts herself or himself in peril and has to get a private, an unlisted address and phone number. But if an assistant U.S. attorney, let's say, wanted to be a part of her zoning and planning board wherever she lived, just nothing to do with what she does for a living, but what she did for a living was complex prosecution of complex international drug rings for the U.S. Attorney's Office, and dealing with some really, really nasty characters. What if she wanted to do that? If she came to one of your city members and said, look, I'd love to do this. This sounds like fun. But I really would prefer that you not make public my home address. What would you advise that person? Would they be out of luck? Or is there some safe haven that you see or your city see in the Data Practices Act, some sort of public safety exception where that person could participate and not have to advertise to the world where they live?
Members of the committee, my name is Ann Higgins from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'll try to answer the question. I'm not sure that I can. If maybe Mr. Deans might be able to help me. But my immediate reaction to the question about whether someone with some other private work outside of the public responsibility that they would take in accepting an appointment or applying for an appointment with the city, I think the only exception that might be available to the city would be if it had related to some kind of security information with respect to law enforcement. But that has it, that characterization that I read in the statute doesn't fit exactly what you're talking about. So I would have to decline, because I'm not an attorney here, to try to figure out whether or not there's an exception. One way I know that cities try to provide a means to contact folks, and it's usually city council members, and I don't know if the counties do likewise. I suspect they may do so, but I haven't questioned them about this, is that we provide a mailing address and a telephone number and email address that is managed by and provided through the city, so that if people are needing to contact and hold those folks accountable for their duties as public officials, either appointed or elected, there is that option. Maybe that would be one way the city could offer and provide, if that would be covered under this language that's here now.
I just want to make sure, Ms. Higgins, I understand you. Since the Data Practices Act only has to do with government data,
right?
And if Joe or Jane Citizen ask for data and you don't have that data,
we didn't collect it.
So are you saying, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but tell me if this is accurate, are you saying that one thing cities could do if they were concerned about that is just not ask? If cities don't have that data, if cities say, look, to be on our Zoning and Planning Commission, just give us an address. It can be your work, it can be your home, whatever. If that's all you have, then the public can only get what you have. They can't pierce that and go through and sort of get.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is some relevance to what you're talking about. The only concern that I still am not clear the answer to is this, namely, if that individual is being asked to consider applying or is interested in applying, one has to establish that that person is eligible to serve, and being a resident of the community would be one of those criteria.
Although, Ms. Higgins, couldn't you just have the person check a box?
Yes, which and say they are, and then you would take that on their...
Right.
Otherwise, if somebody else were to offer contrary information, that they are not.
Mr. Black, I saw you motioning. Do you have something to say on this issue? I think it's a little different from a statewide perspective than it would be from a municipality perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I simply wanted to point out that there's another program which is under Chapter 5B of the statutes. It's the Safe at Home program. Now, that's a more global situation, but it is available to persons like the hypothetical assistant U.S. attorney who have fear for their safety. It's geared more towards survivors of domestic violence, but it is available to somebody in this situation. And at that point, they would use our designated mailing address as their address for all purposes, and their actual address would not be needed to be listed, and that's under current statute.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just talking to Ms. Conyers about some language that we might insert that would maybe allow for there to be a general rule, but something like unless the granting, which authority are we talking about? Unless the appointing authority has reasonably determined that release of the applicant's address will cause a safety risk or something like that, then
then the general rule would be that they have to release the actual address. And I'm wondering if that's a reasonable exception to these situations where someone really does have a legitimate reason to be concerned about safety issues, or if that would be problematic. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out as a possibility for discussion.
Senator Limmer.
Chair, before we get too involved in this debate, I've been trying to get an indication of what's the problem here that we're trying to solve. I haven't heard anyone come to the legislature saying, I really want to be on an advisory council board for potato seed growers, and I don't want anyone to know where I live because I'm fearful of something. I haven't heard anybody on any of these advisory boards saying they have a problem, and I'd like to know, where is this fear originating from anyway? Does anyone have an indication of this?
Senator Lambert, it may just originate from my fevered imagination. I don't know. But I'm just trying to think of situations. The other example, sure. Since we mentioned Safe at Home, I keep using this example of criminal prosecutors, and we have one with us who can probably comment as to that, but what about victims of abuse who, for very real reasons, want to participate
in
the community?
I think in
Senator Limmer,
if we isolated a board that may have some elements of tension that may raise alarm as to some advice that may be given, maybe an individual board or advisory council, due to the nature, maybe on emergency preparedness and terrorist reaction or something, we may want to consider that on an item-by-item basis, but to apply this policy towards every single advisory board and council, I don't know if it's necessary. You know, I couldn't help but, as I was listening to Ms. Higgins talk, and you, Mr. Chair, talk about prosecutors having to have their addresses kind of sealed. I had a bill a number of years ago when I tried to seal the addresses of jurors that are handling cases of street gangs. And Bill Kennedy, the chief defense attorney in Hennepin County at the time, literally ripped my head off for even daring to suggest that, because he, as a defense attorney, needed to have the address in order to do research on what the potential jurors were, what their backgrounds were, in order to maintain and develop defense for his client. Now, this was during a time when street gangs were threatening jurors under different cases. Now, if we can't protect the name of a juror in our court, then why are we going to protect the address of someone that might be on the board of invention or the board of optometry? I guess I'm just trying to figure out, again, the scale and the scope of why this issue is before us in the first place, and a general application to every agency name.
I think Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that the Chair is aware of my opinion on this. Also, being a prosecutor, and for the entirety of the time that I've been in the legislature, I've been a prosecutor, and my address has always been public, and I've gotten threatened plenty in court by different people who, I guess, didn't realize that I didn't care that much. And for the most part, I guess, my thoughts are, if someone really wants to get your address, they're going to get it. I mean, they're absolutely going to get it. They can hang out outside the courthouse, wait till I get home, stalk me, find out where I drive home. They'd have to wait quite a while, because I usually don't go until late. But they'll do that, absolutely, and they'll find out where you live, and I just don't think that these types are the ones that are going to research in the annals of government data practices to find out where I live. They'll just track me. So that's why I think it's just not as much of an issue.
Actually, Senator Olson, did you want
to? I was just wondering if the reason for the temporary classification, if representatives who put the temporary classification into place in the first place, that we're obviously concerned about this issue, and if we should understand from their perspective the rationale.
And that's a great segue, I think. Ms. Barkopensky, could you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Lori Barkopensky, the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration. And could I answer Senator Olson's first question? In the Data Practices Act currently, under 1337, there is already a discretionary area where you would take data that is otherwise public, and you have the ability to withhold it as security information. So, for instance, if you had someone who was an employee, and usually your work location is public data, if you had someone who was a victim of domestic violence, you could hold that back as security information. Or what the airport is using right now to protect credit card numbers, they too, that would be public under the presumption they can use this 1337 to be able to hold that debt back from the public. So there is already a vehicle in existing statute to the extent that a prosecutor or someone else would want to be on one of these boards and have their information protected. And the next question was about the temporary classification. The commissioner received an application from the Bureau, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, about the governor's climate control task force advisory committee. I'm not sure exactly what it was. And someone had made a request for all the addresses of all the people serving on the board. And they had not gone through the open appointments process that Mr. Black described, where you basically get to list where you want to be contacted. So these folks had never been given an opportunity to say, how would you like to be contacted? Your data is going to be public. Make a choice. So they applied to the commissioner. The commissioner said, well, we believe this has statewide applicability because there are other similar boards that are not through the open appointments process that should be treated similarly. So she moved the application statewide and then approved it so that if you are not in an elected position or filled through the open appointments process, your home contact data is going to be private. And that temporary classification is in effect until June 1st of 2010, so you will see it next year. And the application and the approval happened after the legislature had already convened. So that's why you don't have it before you this year. And Representative Holberg's amendment, as Representative Simon mentioned, was a reaction to the temporary classification that the commissioner had approved.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Park? Thank you. Members, having heard the interpretation of 13.37 and its apparent application to the situation, that certainly satisfies me. I don't know, maybe I'm the only one who held the position of skepticism. Looks like maybe I am. And so in that case, I'm wondering if staff could help to tweak the amendment so that we no longer have the, in other words, to tweak it so that it's just ask for the home address, basically. Maybe it's just deleting material. And, yeah. If either or both of you want to elaborate on that. Deleting one more. Oh, you did. Would it be out this amendment? What could be amended? Oh, okay. Line 29 to 30. Okay. All right. Sure. Okay. Members, I think I've been advised that the way to effectuate the change that I just described is to delete from the amendment. It would be amendment to the amendment to delete lines 1.10 through 1.12. No, 1.10 and 1.11. That's it. That would be the amendment to the amendment. Anyone would like to move that?
What are we doing with that phone line?
We're amending the amendment to delete lines 1.10 and 1.11.
Mr. Chair, I would move that, but I would also add to that, which in rechecking what the Senate noticed, changing voluntary to voluntarily, I think which is should be inserted before voluntarily on line 1.8. That way we leave any data required to be provided or which is voluntarily provided rather than any data required to be provided or voluntarily provided. I think that's more appropriate.
Would you, since it's your underlying amendment, would you incorporate both of those into
your
amendment?
Yes, I would.
Okay. Then what I recommend we do is adopt the amendment, which we can do in a minute, and then go back
to the language in the side-by-side, at, well, let's see. The language as amended, and take care of what's in it, the existing language as to this alternative address, and we can get rid of that. I think, Senator Olson.
Representative Letch, rather than saying which is voluntarily provided, would you be okay with that is voluntarily provided?
Absolutely.
Okay. We have that then. That is voluntarily provided. Okay. So, any further discussion on the amendment to the amendment? Oh, no, you just incorporated that, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Sure.
So the amendment has been amended, in essence.
Sure. If I can bring back the language on 8.29, we're going to keep 829 in this amendment, but that means that the applicant can either present a full resident address or an alternate address.
Senator Limmer, my suggestion was that we adopt the amendment as amended and then go back and make the correction that you're talking about, to get rid of the alternate address. I understand that to be the will of the committee. So any other discussion to the amendment as amended? So we're now voting on the underlying, Representative Lesch's underlying A16 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment, the A16 amendment, is adopted. Now, Senator Limmer, as to your concern, which was why we made the tweaks anyway, on line 8.29, I think an amendment would be in order to delete everything after the first word address, and is that correct? Okay. Okay, that's right. Delete the words or an alternate address. Well, and then it says, I see. Yeah, I'd say delete the whole thing. Full resident address. Or an alternate address. Yeah, I think it's probably best to just say delete the words or an alternate address specified by the appointee where, and then delete all of the text on line 8.30. Except not the semicolon.
Correct. Chairman, I think that's right, because the purpose of knowing the address is probably generally not even for reaching the person. Just to know where they
are. Okay. Any discussion to that oral amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. I think, members, maybe we should just take a quick minute to look to see whether what we've done is right, and then we can move adoption of the entire Section 14 as amended. I want to make sure it meets with everyone's approval.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I just wondered if should we say then, I'm just wondering if it sounds appropriate to say full residence address, or whether it shouldn't be residential address. That just seems a little awkward.
Senator Olson, I have no particular opinion. I would defer to staff. Taconius or Mr. Guerin, any thoughts about that?
I like the residential, Mr. Chair. Residential.
Representative Lesch?
I like residential, Mr. Chair.
Residential address?
Yeah.
So the amendment would be to, on line 8.29, delete full residence and insert the word residential.
Yeah, I think we're just changing residence to residential, but
Take out full as well. So, to repeat, I guess, do you want to move that?
I'll move that. Representative
Lesch. So your amendment, as I understand it, is delete the word full residence and in their place insert the word residential.
That's correct.
Any further discussion to that proposed, to that oral amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on the section? Or do you wish to have more time to look it over? Seeing looks of relative contentment with it. So, with that, I will move adoption of Section 14 of the House language as amended. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Okay, the section is adopted. Members, I think there are a couple more technical things that I think we overlooked the other day that are purely technical, like name changes, things like that, or changes in technical terms.
Mr. Chair, yet outstanding is Senate Section 4, which is on page R5-1. It contains technical modifications to Chapter 13.
Section 4 on page R5, I believe this changes, as we've done before, to standardizes the term government entity in place of some of the other terms listed there. Okay, does anyone want to move adoption of Section 4 on that language?
I'll move the adoption.
Okay, Senator Olson moves adoption of Section 4 of the Senate language on page R5-1, starting with line 3.22. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting Senate language in Section 4, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. The section is adopted. Mr. Garing? Oh. Mr. Garing, you want to comment on Section 5?
Mr. Chair, we previously adopted House Section 8, which is identical.
Oh, okay. Good. There. Do members have any further discussion of things that we should adopt into the conference report? I just might add that I know there are people here who may have other provisions in the bill that they wanted adopted. We had to make a decision, obviously, about what goes in and what ends up on the cutting room floor. One thing in particular that I want to just state for the record, looks like she's talking to Senator Limmer right now, but for Ms. Bart Kopensky, who I know worked quite hard on the civil investigative data issue, and I know she accommodated many people's concerns. Some of those people are in the room here. I think we decided, though, jointly, at least Senator Olson and I in talking and then talking with our conferees, we really felt that it was a good idea to give this a little bit more time. A lot of us had questions about the intersection between 13.39 and 13.41 with the licensing data. My sense is that people are not against it. They just want to get a feel for how that's really going to work, especially since we're expanding the definition of license now, or actually, no, we're changing the definition, not necessarily expanding it. So that's why that's not coming in. Is there anyone else who has anything else to say about items in the bill or not in the bill? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on your comments related to those provisions, we also felt that rather than piecemealing acceptance of certain pieces that seemed the least controversial, that it made more sense, if there's going to be work on this in the interim, to look at the whole big picture and then to adopt everything at once in a way that made sense to everyone. And that seemed to be the better approach. And there were parts of the provisions that we never got to in our discussions on the Senate side. And so, again, there were really more questions than we had answers for, so we just didn't feel comfortable going ahead until we could see the broader picture.
I have a question just for staff. So at this point, I think we're ready to adjourn, unless there's further discussion. My question is, well, I guess, what do we do about logistically about the conference report here?
Just in terms of signing?
Yeah.
Well, I think as soon as the report is ready.
So I guess my question is, we can adjourn and then just sign the conference report. Okay. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, yes. Ms. Pines and I will work together and take the language that's been adopted to the advisor, and the advisor will put together the final report and sign a file will be sent to Senator Olson to collect the signatures.
So does anyone have objections to adjourning at this point?
Well, I think we need to move to adopt.
Yes, we do.
The conference report before we do that.
Sounds like you just did.
Well, I think Senator Olson just
did. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I'll move to adopt the conference committee report with the language that's been incorporated through the committee.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Any further discussion on adoption of the conference report? Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Members, thank you very much. I just want to say, too, I really want to thank staff here as well. I know Ms. Pontius, Mr. Gehring, Ms. Weeks, Mr. Verdon, Mr. Baldwin, all really helped out quite a bit on this, and thank them for their hard work and patience with all of us and with the process. And thanks to everyone who came and was a part of this hearing as well. Members, if there's nothing further, we are adjourned.